Thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we are going to start the show today by hearing stories about the folks of Wisconsin, what they're up to this summer, all over the state, with our guest Mike Beno, editor of Our Wisconsin magazine. Mike's going to tell us stories about a crazy, silly marching band that I've seen and heard many times, and I chuckle every time. We'll talk about pickling, we'll talk about sleeping in a World War II plane, and a whole lot more. And as we listen to Mike talk, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you have a story for Our Wisconsin magazine. Or you could share what you enjoyed reading in the last issue, or maybe you have an event you want to talk about that's going on in your part of the state. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Mike Beno, always good to have you back. Thanks for joining in.
Hey, Larry, thanks so much for the invitation. It's always a lot of fun to not only talk with you, but the listeners that call in. As you've mentioned, we've gleaned more than a few story tips from folks who call in and let us know what's going on in their corner of Wisconsin. Great place to live. Unusual things are happening.
Yeah, there sure are. You know, I as always, I go through the entire magazine, and right away on the inside flap of this issue is a really beautiful picture of a lighthouse. And even though we're not a state that borders the ocean, you're right, we have plenty of lighthouses in our state. Maybe you can give us some examples of a few notable ones.
Yeah, it really is. I'm glad you started with this. It's a photo by Rob Resnick of Oshkosh. And when you think of lighthouses in Wisconsin, my mind goes to Door County right away, because that county has more lighthouses, 10 of them, than any other county in the nation. This one is it's beautiful. It's Wind Point Lighthouse near Racine. And that particular compound of buildings also is the municipal buildings for the village of Wind Point. A police department, a village hall. So that's got to be about the most unusual municipal building in the state, I would say.
It's so.
And you know, it's beautiful. It's the tallest lighthouse in the state, and it was built in 1880. And it was first lit then, and remains lit to this day. And this is part of just the very unique nautical maritime heritage of a Midwestern state right in the middle of flyover country, you know, for the coast people. Well, we're a little bit more special than that. When you've got, 600 miles of the Lake Michigan shoreline and another 100 on Lake Superior, this was a place where it was highways and byways for commerce, travel,
sure,
with all the shipwrecks, the rivers as well. They're right near you in Lake Mendota. They're finding the old freighter canoes that the Indian tribes had. So we had a lot of travel around here, maybe much more so than the old wagon rutted trails heading out west. A lot of that went on. So back to the lighthouses, I mean, we've got, like I said, 11 in Door County. There's nearly 50 here in the state, and as I mentioned, some of them are still lit. The one at Wind Point, you can climb the 144 spiral stairs to get up there and take a look. There's a very small charge for that. Private group climbs can be arranged. So windpointlighthouse.org, give it a look for some cool history, and you can go on out and see it.
That's a great photo. I wondered if he used a drone for that, or did he?
Yeah, and you know, he surely did. The drone photography that we're seeing more and more is really a treat, because, you know, anybody who's done photography on the ground, you work hard to get a vantage point, and sometimes you can't get the shot as wide as you want. And just taking that angle from above can change the completely change it. And that's pointed out well. One other example of this, and this was in the center of the magazine, we have a three-page panoramic picture, and there was a picture of some Amishmen near Cashton working in their hay field with a pair of workhorses, and this was, I think, by the same photographer. These guys are down there, and I was talking to another Amishman, this one from Kennan. He knows quite a few of the people in that community around the state. He said, I know those guys. I know that team of horses. And if you look, one horse is looking over his shoulder up at that drone. I didn't even pick that up, but the Amishman did. It's fun to see that kind of work coming through now.
Yeah, it is indeed. It's a beautiful, some beautiful photography there. Airbnbs are getting very popular. In fact, our own Jill Nadeau has one in Watertown. Anyway, there's a really unique one in Deerbrook.
Thank you. Thanks for that lead-in.
Oh, my gosh.
Airbnb, this takes Airbnb to a completely different height, doesn't it?
It sure does. We got a World War II plane.
Yes. And hey, and that's, you know, with all this D-Day news and stuff like that, this this DC-3 Douglas Aircraft DC-3, the last one of these transports was built in 1945. There's 150 still flying today. What Larry's talking about here, for the folks who haven't seen this, is one of those rare DC-3s made its way to Deerbrook near Antigo due to a very entrepreneurial businessman up there who's got some unique places to stay. So Joe Drager, and that's a pretty big name around that area. The family has supplied LP gas forever. Joe heard about I got to back up here. He's got a treehouse that he rents out, okay, for a B&B, and it is an Airbnb. It's up in the air. It's all tricked out. He's got a refurbished barn. They rent that out. And he was kicking around the web, and he saw in Venezuela there was a sort of airplane kind of B&B. It really amounted to a cockpit and a couple of wings, and, you know, it gave the flavor of air travel. He said, what if we could have people really stay in an airplane? So he started looking around for a sizable one, and he located in Oshkosh at Basler's Conversions. They restored the DC-3, and the civilian version is C-47. Their military aircraft, the DC-3, to haul a lot of people around. He found one that was about meant for salvage. It wasn't going to be refurbished. He bought it, okay, had it trucked up north, and got a couple of his very handy guys together. Now, this old military aircraft flew in the Pacific Theater between Guam and Midway and Pearl Harbor. In October of 22, it became Joe's, got her on a flatbed, brought it to Antigo, and they're working on it in the warehouse. They've got this thing now rebuilt and looking spiffy new to specifications. It's up in the treetops. It's raised, and you can rent this thing out. It's got beds. It's got bathrooms. There's a deck on the outside with a couple of chairs and a gas grill. The propellers turn. He had to kind of sort of work those up out of ceiling fans. It's got lights all over it. People have come from as far away as Germany to spend a night in this plane. And it's got a lounge area. It really is something neat to see. My guess is there may be a little bit of a waiting period because in the story we met at least one pilot whose wife gifted him with a stay in this Airbnb. So the sky's the limit with creativity of the people in Wisconsin. Way cool.
It is really cool. That would be something, if you didn't know it was there and you came upon it, it would be quite a shock to the system almost.
How'd that plane land in the middle of the trees? I don't know.
Oh, man. Well, let's. And by the way, we're talking about the June-July issue of our Wisconsin magazine, and you guys come out how many times a year? You come out six, is it?
Six times a year, yeah. So every other month. So this is our June-July issue, and next up will be August-September. And prior to that, we had April-May, and here's some fun stories in that one too. But I better stay on task.
Well, one of the, my daughter and I visited a lavender farm in Door County and just loved the lavender farm, but I didn't quite go as far as this couple from Wautoma, I believe. Wautoma, they visited the fields in Door County as well.
Yeah, and we have covered that story before, the Door County. Specifically Washington Island, there are a couple of lavender farms up there.
Yep.
Have generated a lot of attention over the last 10 years, I would say. And I think they have a little bit more of a presence on the mainland in Door County, so people aren't limited by the ferry schedule. But, yeah, up in Washington Island, there's a couple of them. This couple from Wautoma, Nicole and Joe Lair, we're up visiting, like you and your daughter did, and we're taken with it so much that they got in the car and they're on the way home thinking, could we do something like that? They live on a family farm acreage there in Wautoma. They both have full-time jobs, though, you know, and it's going to take some work to establish an agricultural operation there. And they decided, you know what, let's go for it, because she is so taken, Nicole, by the fragrant flowers. I mean, how many people are? It's said to have medicinal and therapeutic benefits. You can consume it. It's believed to help with stress, anxiety, depression, insomnia, a lot of different things. But they're just beautiful flowers with a wonderful fragrance. And so they went ahead and did a whole bunch of study. You know, there's 45 different species of lavender and more than 450 cultivars. What's going to grow in this area? Well, you know, it's growing in Washington Island, but perhaps you've had enough horticulture people on there with their different maps and things. What's going to grow in the middle of the state?
Yeah.
And they came upon about 11 different cultivars that would work, and they trial and error, 250 plants each time. They're plugging them in and seeing what'll work. They learned early on there's a certain one that really needs some snow cover to make it through winter, and they lost a few plants learning that lesson when we had a thin snow winter here recently. But they're up and running and doing well. And Joe is working on the laborious part of it out in the fields, I would guess. And meanwhile, Nicole is coming up with products. She's cooking up in her kitchen, you know, facial toner, body butter, soaps, shower steamers, bath bombs, bouquets, sachets, anything you could put this perennial to use with, they're raising there. And, you know, they can devote maybe 4 hours a day to it or an hour or two a night. They got to work. So anyway, there's information online. They got tea and brownie mix, too. And you can do yoga in a lavender field. Larry, I'll meet you there, all right?
That sounds like a plan. That sounds like a plan, Mike. Mike Vino, our guest today, editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine, and you can join in. Questions, comments, maybe a story suggestion. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mike Beno, editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine. Always great to have him come by to talk about what's going on in the magazine. And there are always some great stories and certainly a lot of wonderful photography as well. Bill and Ladysmith has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, gentlemen. I love the magazine. I read it as often as I can. I have a suggestion for you. I have been volunteering at our local library here in Ladysmith the past year, a little over a year, and I did not realize how many programs are actually put on for children, for adults, for community members. I think it would be doing the library system and also the state a good service. They're letting people know what everything that is involved, and
yeah, Bill, you are right. Libraries are the Wisconsin libraries are amazing. And Mike, I'm not sure. Have you done stories on Wisconsin libraries at all?
On libraries per se, no, we haven't. But Bill, you're on the right track. What's astonishing to me about libraries is now in the digital age, okay, when I think of libraries, I think of stacks and stacks and stacks of books and Carnegie and all the history. But now in the digital age, libraries, I believe, are really remain at the center of the community. They have so many different services, not only with what they lend out, the books, the magazines, the DVDs, different materials. There is no one more helpful in the world than a librarian, and I can say that because I cannot believe how many, when I was looking for a book, to what lengths some of these
yes.
librarians go to track that thing down in the interlibrary loan system around the nation. It's crazy. Sometimes I was working on an article here and there. Sometimes 2 months later, I'll get a phone call. We found your book. Well, I've already written that story, but I didn't have the heart to say, sorry, I don't need it anymore. And I went right down and picked it up, and I read it, by gosh, because someone's going to work that hard for me. It's got to be worth something. One of our neighbors up in the woods here in the town of Presque Isle, Pam Eschenbach, was a librarian at this smaller library for 34 years, and know her pretty well. And in this small library, there's, you know, the community's maybe 500 people for the whole township. They came together 15 years ago, I think, put a $600,000 renovation in there in this small town, including an elevator. I mean, there's barely any cars in this town. So, yeah, it is the center of the community and what good work they do. And, yeah, kids hour, kids activities, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I was thinking about the Madison Library System. If you rip your pants, Mike, you can go to the main library and there's somebody there that'll sew your pants up for you.
Wow. How did you know I was gaining weight? Now, what about darning socks? I think I have maybe two or three deer hunting socks where there's still that my grandma did some darning on the toes, and she was born in 1913. Darn socks, I got to quit throwing them away. I got to learn how to do that.
Mike Beno, our guest. Questions, comments, and Bill from Ladysmith, you should write a story about the Ladysmith Library and send it off to Mike and see what he thinks, if he can use it. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. You know, there's a hilarious story. Clara Neipert and I were laughing about it this morning about a boy's trip to Turtle Lake in northern Wisconsin.
So, Larry, when you were 15 years old, you didn't try to sneak any beer past your parents, did you?
I'm not talking about that. I've got a story to tell you, but I want to hear theirs first.
Okay. You know, I thought about that story this morning, the one you're talking about, and honestly, this happened in 1950. Now, the magazine has current stories as well as memories, but this is a memory that a man, Dave Caswell, now lives in Portland, Oregon, originally from the Madison area. He's carried this story around in his mind for 70 years, 75, 74 years. That's what it would be, 1950.
Oh, man.
Today. So he and his 15-year-old buddies, six of them, decided they really needed to go on a trip. I don't know why one of their parents went with us, but up in Turtle Lake, they had a cottage, Barron and Polk Counties, right at the edge of the county line there, Turtle Lake. And the boys, six of them, are going to go up there for a week. And the parents nod and say, "Yep, you can go up, guys. Unsupervised, we'll let you go there." And so they two of Bill's parents drive them up from Madison, Turtle Lake, 4 hours, and Mom saying, "Sing along, boys, sing the old song." "Oh, Mom, come on, you know, don't make the guys do that. Well, we'll play 20 questions then." "Oh, Mom." So they pull into the driveway at this cottage, and here's what their parents are going to be heading down the road. He kisses his parents goodbye quick. They're gone. Okay, they're gone. Now, we got a week of telling dirty jokes and fishing and smoking cigars and eating weenies and beans, and we're going to play cards, and, we're going to drink some beer, 15-year-olds. So six of them get in this old wooden leaky boat, and the parents are 10 minutes down the road. They're rowing across the lake to get to the general store up in Vacation Land, Wisconsin, for a little provender. They got some eggs and some maybe a little milk and a loaf of bread, but they didn't want to waste their money on too much of that junk. And so they bought about a case and a half of beer because one of the kids started shaving, and he looked a little older. So they sent him in to the old boy at the store, and they start rowing back across the lake. Well, they're heading right back to the cabin, and one guy in the boat says, "Hey, Kasia, is that your parents on the dock?" "Oh, what now?" Got him red-handed, almost. Mom's waving and saying, "Billy forgot here's his asthma pills. We brought them back." Yeah, Mom, leave them on the table. "What are we going to do here?" "No, you boy." So thinking quick, one guy says, "Here, grab this musky net." They load in the contraband, and they tie a rope on it, and they sink her down into the water and stand there hailing Mom, you know. And pretty soon, you know, they're sweating it, but she turns and leaves. "Okay, we love you, boys." Okay, got past that one. They go to pull up the contraband. And back in the days before nylon nets, what happened to those old musky nets, Larry? You used them too many years.
Oh, yeah. They got holes.
They tear. And, you know, how many fishermen has a horrible story about losing a trophy musky with it because they're too cheap to buy a new net? Well, yeah, that happened. Net ripped open. Everything went to the bottom. And so their plans were ruined. They went and got the biggest baits out of their tackle box with gang hooks and dragged the bottom, and they caught walleyes and northerns and all this stuff they didn't want. And
and they never caught they never got a beer.
They never got a beer, but really at the end, many, many years later, Mom says to him, hey, "Did you guys ever get that beer off the bottom of Turtle Lake?"
Oh, my gosh. It reminded me of a story of my own when I was a young man, but I was older than that. But staying with my parents, and they went away for a week's vacation or 2 week vacation, and I was left at home and decided to have a party. A beer and pop party, but a little of both, but all in cans. And they were coming home on Sunday, and so Saturday, I had the party Friday night, and Saturday morning, I got up, and I just took all the cans of beer and pop empties and put them in the garage. And a little later, I hear a car pulling in the driveway, and it was my mom and dad coming home a day early. and he opened, and I had kind of, the cans and that were all piled up against the garage door. And when he hit the garage door opener, it came up and the cans came tumbling out.
I bet you they were sorry they missed that party.
I think they were laughing so hard. Oh man.
Busted.
Busted. Oh man. Well, you know, moving on from that story.
Put you on the spot. I won't get invited back on this show anymore.
I really had a wonderful time in Bayfield last Friday. And we were broadcasting from Bayfield in Bloom to kind of kick it off for their week of celebration. And then I open your magazine and I see pretty remote restaurant called Air Haven. It used to be anyway. It was on one of the Apostle Islands right off of Bayfield. Some people might think this would be an unusual place for a restaurant to spring up. And I thought the story of how that restaurant got going was really cool.
Yeah, thank you for that. And Bayfield and Bloom, Bayfield, what a treasure. And this time of year, when you take the highway north of there and around the corner by the Victorian homes and start heading north, there are so many spring plantings that just pop up.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. But, we're talking about the Apostle Islands, National Lakeshore, and Wisconsin's most northern eating place once was there. Now, this is all national parkland at this point, and it's a treasure. There's only five national lakeshores in the nation. They're right up there with the national parks. It's a kind of a relative. Apostle Islands and Indiana Dunes, Sleeping Bear Dunes, Pictured Rocks. But we have the Apostles, 22 islands there. And a lady who grew up there, Julie Norris from Ashland, she sent in a little while ago, you suggested Bill should write up a little story for us. This is how most of these stories land here. Julie grew up on the Apostles in summertime at her grandparents' place, Wisconsin's most northern eating place. Rocky Island is about 1,100 acres. It's on the far northern edge of the archipelago there. You can it's part of the park. You can go camping on four or five rough sites today. But you're gonna, if you do with your kayaks, you're gonna land right at a docking area, which handled this restaurant. Julie's grandparents in the 1930s, her grandfather was a commercial fisherman, whitefish, lake trout, and he also guided people fishing among the islands. And then as he was guiding people out there, they'd get hungry. And so they thought, well, we could feed them a little something. So his wife and he made a little place there where they could have coffee and some pie, homemade pie. Well, that caught on pretty well. And so they decided, you know, more and more people heard about it. Pretty soon the excursion boat from Bayfield, taking people through all the islands, started stopping. Well, they couldn't handle that with one little icebox. So they built themselves a cottage, I guess it'd be a dining hall, really. You could seat 100 people. And he would bring people out to the island. Eventually, he became the excursion boat captain. And they were bringing out 100 people to come out there and eat. I don't think Grandma liked that very well, because she was getting up at 5 a.m. to bake about 10 pies and bake all the bread. So they hired help. And they had sandwiches, and they had homemade bread, and they had fresh lake trout and whitefish with scalloped potatoes and coleslaw. And Julie, the writer, sent in pictures of her at age 2 sitting on the dock, and also old placemats from this restaurant from, you know, from the 50s, and you're out there on the northernmost edge of the Apostles, and the storms had come roaring in, and the staff, they'd have to hunker down in these little cottages and ride out these fierce storms and then clean up the beach because a whole bunch of stuff had come in. And this was where she spent her summers. And the waitresses came back year after year because they were like family. And, in, you know, all good things come to an end. And this came to an end for a good reason. In 62, Gaylord Nelson, the governor, made the push to preserve this these islands in this place. And Congress named it a national lakeshore in 1970, became parks. And little by little, the people who owned this land, they had lifetime leases, and little by little, as they went away, then the park took over. They did it in a very humane way. So in 74, Rocky Island Air Haven kind of came to an end. But the family still goes out to this island every year to tell the new ranger all the history, where we stayed, where what this dock did, where we cleaned the fish, all those kind of things. And it's this kind of unusual stuff and traditions and stories that's so special about Wisconsin, and we're very lucky here to be able to tell these stories.
Yeah, it's a great, great story, and I loved reading it. Our guest today, Mike Beno, editor of Our Wisconsin magazine. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Some emails coming in here, Mike, and maybe we can comment on them. Owen emailed, just reminding listeners that Cornucopia will be having its Lupin Festival this coming Saturday.
Okay.
All sorts of events, garage sales, music, amazing food. It's a kickoff to the Cornucopia concert series that happens at the coffee shop, deck, and lawn. Subsequent concert events are going to be held every Thursday evening at 6 for the rest of the summer. Some dude named Owen will be playing the keyboard from noon till 3. Just coming off an interview last month on Robin Washington's Simply Superior show. So Cornucopia Lupin Festival.
Corny is a wonderful place to go to. It's just up the road from where we've been talking about in Bayfield. Mercer as well on June 8th, they have their Mercer Lupin June Fest. So there's blossoming lupins in Iron County, and they've got a path for bicyclists to take and go and see the all the different colors as these plants are popping up in June. It starts at Carroll Park in Mercer on June 8th.
And Laurel emailed us, Central Wisconsin, west of Oshkosh and east of Wautoma is Red Granite, and they hold a community market in Veterans Park right on Route 21. Market's fun, including Tai Chi, local artisans of various crafters, of course, food vendors, and music running every Saturday from 8 to 3 all summer into October. And you had a nice photo in the book of Main Street in Oshkosh. Shoppers Throw on in the central
in the photo essay.
Yeah, in the photo essay.
Sure, we've got a full page worth of it is what we have. Main Street in Oshkosh. Their farmers market is huge there, and that happens Saturday from June 1st. Right through to October 26, two downtown blocks, a lot going on. And I'm glad you mentioned Red Granite, too, because my cousin Susie's from there, and she'd shoot me if I didn't mention her.
Oh, man. Sharon in Lake Tomahawk. We'll go to you. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Okay. You were talking about different events to do in different towns. We have snowshoe baseball all summer, which starts on June 17th and goes until August 26th, every Monday.
Snowshoe baseball in the summer?
In the summer, you bet.
Wow. Larry, have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
You know what? They will let you play. You just go talk to Jeff, the guy who puts this thing on. And, I mean, he grooms the mound, he grooms the infield, all of that. And if you ask to be put in the lineup, he will give you 47-inch tails, snowshoes to put on your feet, and you'll get out there. And the secret is, don't take off running like you're in a track meet coming out of the blocks. Shuffle. You got to learn to shuffle. And at my age, I shuffle anyway. Sharon, do you work there?
I am the clerk in the town of Lake Tomahawk, yes.
Do you bake pies for this thing?
I'm not a baker. I can buy them, but I don't bake them.
The ladies in town, how many pies would you say they create before this Monday deal?
They at least do 50, 60 pies every Monday.
Oh, my goodness.
And they're coming from everyone in the town and every household. And I could buy a slice of 53 different kind of pies and eat them right there, I bet.
You betcha.
Oh, man. Larry, homemade pie, you get to play, wear snowshoes in the summertime. I mean, how can you beat it?
I don't think you can. Sharon, thank you very much for calling. I played a lot of ball in my life, but I never played with snowshoes on.
What's interesting about this is it's gone on for decades, and the town does not have any school system, okay? It's one of the small rural towns up here, and so usually, you know, the school events, the games and the proms and all those homecomings, that's kind of the central to these smaller communities. When you don't have that, well, they've got a little rallying thing here with claim to fame with the snowshoe baseball. And these are some good players. They are. I mean, regular softball players. And now on 4th of July, for the last few years, they've got some friends. A lot of people from friends from Illinois will come up and to the Lakes region here. It's not far from Minocqua. And these guys will come and they will camp or wherever they can, stay in the yards of these ball players from up here. They're the Chicago All-Stars and they're City League players from down there. And they'll play against the Snowhawks up here in a game, and they'll, you know, wearing snowshoes. And the Snowhawks are good players, and they kind of prevail in snowshoes. Then they take the snowshoes off on 4th of July and play these guys for real. And it is some 3,000 people come and watch this. It's
wow.
Really interesting and fun. It's always a lot of fun.
Oh, man. Sharon, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very, very much. Mike Bino, our guest editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Mike Bino, editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine, about all of the events and things that go on and are reported on in the magazine. Always great to have Mike come by. I love talking with him. Alan in Silver Lake has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, gentlemen. How's everything today?
It's wonderful. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, Mr. Bino, I want to congratulate you on an excellent magazine.
Well,
I look forward to every issue of that magazine. It's just fantastic. I've given several as gifts in 112 Library in northern Wisconsin. But I have a question on the submission of vintage postcards.
Okay.
I sent about 30 or 40 to your location, but they were returned as being... unusable because I did not have a direct connection to any of the people appearing on those cards. And I was wondering why. I thought they would be very historical.
Yeah.
But evidently not.
Well, and what you're putting your finger on is something that we run into quite often with, let's say, a photographer has a whole bunch of a pretty big portfolio of work, and that person dies, okay? And usually those pictures are very general in nature, and also sometimes there's not a whole lot of information with them. And so we try to tell a little bit more of a story, tied to families and people here in the state. Now, there is, for example, our vintage view section. I'm looking on page 78, 79. We have, it's all black and white pictures, and we are looking for pictures that people send in, and they can identify some of the folks that are in there and say, that's my uncle, that's my grandmother, that's my grandfather on the far right, et cetera. It's for us, it's not quite enough to have it be a look at the early days. What we want is to keep the personal connections of the people there and maybe a memory or two and have it be tied to families, friends. It just personalizes it a little bit more, and that's just the approach we take. Your pictures may well be very sharp or good ones, really, but we want to take it a little further into having it be a little more personalized.
Yeah, I like that. The photos, they're great. That, for example, the ones you have in this issue. But the stories, the little stories that they tell about the people in the photos, I think is what really makes it interesting.
Yeah, it's more of a make. The cover says Wisconsin. That's a place, okay? But the magazine's really more about the people. And so we try to tell a little bit more of that.
Alan, thank you for calling. I hope that helped. Linda in Edgerton had sent an email wondering why they can't post picks anymore. They haven't been able to send in a pick for Pick of the Day in a long time.
Oh, on Facebook, Pick of the Day. Well, I wish somebody... Could you call Mr. Zuckerberg for us? So, Picture of the Day. We've had, Larry, I know Wisconsin Public Radio had quite a big Facebook presence for a while and went on to other things. It took us a little while to do that as well, only because one day we suddenly could not access our account. We had built it up to about 31,000 followers, and people would put on their Picture of the Day. We'd invite people to do that, and people would comment. A nice little community building thing, you know, and nothing wrong with that at all. And so we liked that. Then one day, and Wendy here in our office could had them scheduled out. You can automatically schedule them for a week, and they just stopped. And went, we contacted Facebook, worked at it, and kept hitting a dead end. And finally, a dead end was hit when somebody at Facebook said, send us a copy of your driver's license, Mr. Bino. And I said, no. At some point, you got to protect yourself when you're in the internet realm. And that didn't seem very prudent to me. So we have a much smaller Facebook presence, but we're not putting much emphasis on it. So we would love to do it, but somehow the plug got pulled on it. On that account.
Yeah, that's too bad. I wanted to say, Nancy and Sheldon emailed us. The Rusk County Museum has up to 20 buildings and exhibits, including a new Anishinaabe exhibit housing an authentic wigwam located in Geodesic Dome and on their museum campus. They also house Wisconsin Plow Museum, open every weekend from 12:30 to 4:30, free admission, with their season running from Memorial Day through Labor Day. And this Saturday, they have a great opening of their new sidewalk, connecting every building exhibit and honoring the 10-year-old student from Bruce, Cal Meinke, who won the putt-putt car naming contest.
I love that stuff. Brat Fry's car naming contest. This is so Wisconsin. Where is that community again?
It's in Rusk County. The Rusk County Museum. It has up to 20 buildings and exhibits.
Wow. Wow, I didn't realize it was that extensive. They've got the Native American Anishinaabe there. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that might make a nice little story for somebody to write for you.
Yeah, we invite people to send in their stories in letter form. If a little bit of editing is needed, that's fine. We can do that. But people send us stories with heart in it. We do our best to keep the heart in that story and help them tell it.
Yeah. Well, page 75 of your magazine, we had the electric lines explosions story, which I had to mention that today. I read that. I couldn't believe it.
That's one of a couple of Chippewa Falls stories entries. We ask people to, we prompt them and give them ideas what kind of subjects to send to us. My most embarrassing moment, and people, after enough years have gone by, they can finally smile about things like that. But a reader, Joy Dobos from Chippewa Falls, was talking about her birthday in 83. In the office, people she worked with gave her a nice balloon bouquet, silvery, kind of Mylar, I would guess. There are five of them. And she wanted to bring them home and show her kids. So she puts them in her car and rolls down the window and fights these five things in there because they're helium balloons and they're banging around. And she gets them in the car. And pretty soon they're pummeling the back of her head because of the way she's got the windows set up. So she needs to change that around. So she's cracks some different windows as she's driving, pulls into the gas station in Chippewa. And also she goes out to pump her gas. Her balloons are gone. So she yells to the gal at the next island, "Hey, did you see my balloons?" She says, "They went that away." She looks, oh, no. She goes running after her balloons. They're flying off, and finally they caught on a power pole behind the gas station, and she's standing there wondering what she's going to do. And these sort of metallic balloons are whipping around in the wind, and one caught a hot wire up on this post and explodes in the alley there behind the gas station. Boom. Oh, no. And pretty soon they're all popping, bang, 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 and landing in pieces. And she's standing there looking at it with these ribbons tangled up there. And as this last balloon dies, the electric lines start exploding, flying off the pole. And this is happening right down the alley, one pole after another pole after another pole. There are about third or fourth of them. Explosions going on behind this gas station, electrical. She's looking at this stuff. She runs back to her car, and she sees the lights are knocked out in the gas station, and then she hears sirens. So she rushes to the police station, and there's, in the dark, officers flying around in the dark, not knowing what's going on. And, you know, and she said, I know what happened. I know. Okay. What happened? She gives them all the info. The squad cars and fire trucks and everything's flying around. They let her go. Monday morning on the front page of the Chippewa Herald Telegram, not only did they report the incident, they named her. And it knocked out power for the north end of that town, plus the town of Tilden nearby. And, so this is, on Tuesday, the next day, her friend sent her another bouquet to replace them, but she was a little more careful with these.
Oh, man. That's a great story. The other story I wanted to quickly mention, we just got a minute or so, the Will Eske Band, which I have seen perform so many times, and so has Jill. And I forget their title now. The
Yankee Dutchman Solar Powered Precision Marching Band.
Oh, they are so much fun to watch.
And because it's not so unexpected?
Yeah. I mean, they're doing all kinds of crazy stuff while they're marching along and playing.
They were founded in 56 as a regular old polka band called the Yankee Dutchman, and Will Esk, who founded them, wanted to put on a little more of a show. So they went ahead, and they're free to get their own uniforms going. They will play for a while, and as they take a break, they all lie down on the ground. They'll get up and start playing again in a tightening circle till they never miss a beat.
You know what? And we have to miss a beat. Thank you so much. Mike Bino, get a copy of Take a Look at Our Wisconsin Magazine. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Thank you so much for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about some of the earliest life forms that used to live right here in Wisconsin. Couple of guests for you today. One of our guests is Scott Schaefer. He's interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at the UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it very much. Our other guest, Ken Gass, back with us. He's an honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, specializes in Paleozoic life in Wisconsin. And Ken, good to have you back with us.
Great to be back. Thank you.
As we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you could share your favorite facts about our state's natural history. Have you visited maybe the Earth Science Museum recently? Have you found something from a long, long ago, maybe a fossil in your area, maybe right on your own property? Love to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Ken, just start with you for a minute, and Paleozoic, what does that term really mean?
Well, that is a period of time that was marked the first animal fossils and the first explosion of life on the planet, as far as the fossil record goes. It was about, I'm looking at my notes here just to make sure I get the right amount of time here. But the Cambrian was the first period of it, and that one started about 538 million years ago, so it's well over half a billion years ago. And we do have animal and plant life from the Cambrian period here in Wisconsin. So it's I could tell you more about that. I've done two programs on it on the show here already, but I can definitely give you some more stuff about that as far as some really great discoveries that were found here.
It's really cool. And I think the question that always comes to mind right off the bat is, how in the heck do we know what we know about the Paleozoic area and life so long ago?
Fossils, mostly. That is the record of life, basically, going all the way back. And we've got an abundance of those throughout most of the Paleozoic, not all of it, but like at least two-thirds of the Paleozoic, and then a very big gap, the Mesozoic era, which is the era following the Paleozoic. We had virtually nothing. There was one little formation called the Windrow and the Cretaceous, which is, of course, the time of the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have any dinosaurs from Wisconsin, although they were probably alive here. It's just that we had this little thing going through called the glaciers, and there was a lot of other erosion before that as well that just kind of scraped away, bulldozed away most of the Mesozoic rocks. So we don't have any dinosaurs here. So interesting stories about that. There is a gizzard stone that was found out west, the rock from it was traced back to possibly being from Wisconsin. So there might have actually been a dinosaur that picked that rock up from Wisconsin, as they would anything for their, in the gizzard stones, and went back to out west. And when it died, its gizzard stone was preserved next to its bones, and that stone was probably from Wisconsin. So we kind of figured that there were dinosaurs here, regardless of that. But just so far, no bones have been found or any other fossil remains of dinosaurs.
How is our understanding? I'm just wondering, this geological time scale, has our understanding of it changed much, let's say, over the last century or so?
I'd say the main thing is I noticed in my lifetime, it seems that we've pushed back the scale a little further, just with more refined techniques of dating things. There's been quite a while that we've had a lot of development in the dating techniques with potassium argon for the younger fossils and uranium decay for the oldest ones. And that kind of indicates what the absolute age is of these events.
Really cool. And what can we see and observe here in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, we can see a lot of the Paleozoic rocks. As well, of course, as Scott can tell you more about the Pleistocene, especially the Ice Age type sediments. And of course, the rocks are all different kinds. We have, as far as the life goes, the oldest life that we have preserved is in fossils in Wisconsin goes back about a little over a billion years, and that was in the form of stromatolites, which are a type of bacteria. So this is before there were any plants or animals on the Earth. But in Wisconsin, we do have some of these stromatolites, which are a type of a bacteria that would secrete a slimy substance, and then the sediment that was falling down on top of it would stick to it, and then you'd have one layer after another, so they were very thin laminations, just a big dome. It doesn't look like too much, but that was the kind of life that we had.
It's really interesting. Scott, maybe I want you to chime in for sure. Maybe first, let me just ask you to talk a bit about the Weiss Museum itself and what people can find there.
Sure. The Weiss Earth Science Museum, we're located, like you introduced us here, at the UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. And we are Wisconsin's official mineralogical museum. We were designated that upon opening. And we do have a lot of exhibits and features that highlight the geological processes that have shaped our state over its roughly 2.8 billion years of history.
That's really, really cool. And your area of concentration, talk about it for a bit.
My background is in paleontology. Sort of like your other guest, Ken, I am quite partial to the Paleozoic, which we do have represented quite well across the state. But working within my discipline, especially at the Weiss Museum, I kind of have to know a little bit about the breadth of the geologic history. And so I'm definitely looking into expounding a bit on some of our Ice Age deposits that we have as well. But we have beautiful representations of a lot of this throughout our adorable little museum that we have.
That is very, very cool. Ken, I know you wrote a book about the Milwaukee form, what's called the Milwaukee Formation. And I thought it was kind of cool because there's cement companies involved in this.
Yeah, wrote a book about it, so it's too much to talk about to get into detail. But yes, and that is a sequence of rock. The Milwaukee Formation is a sequence of rock strata or layers that contain the fossils of the life that was alive at that time, and which was the age of the fishes. So a lot of the fossils that you'll find there, although they're kind of rare, but when you find them, they're very conspicuous, are from fish of various kinds, very strange kinds. We had the big, the arthrodeer called Eastmanosteus, which is about the size of a great white shark that was swimming around in Milwaukee at that time. And this was about 385 million years ago. And lots of other different kinds of fish, sharks, very simple, primitive sharks, nothing real specialized. And then it was also the age of the brachiopods, and I know that's one of the little subspecialties that Scott has. He might want to talk more about that, but brachiopods and a lot of the other more common animals that used to live in the Devonian seas, that's the age of the period that we're talking about. Trilobites, corals, echinoderms, things like that that all lived at that time. But I think the most exciting things are the things that people at least perk up the most about are these Prototaxites, which is a giant fungus that was the size of a tree. And that is, at the earlier part of the Devonian, that was the tallest organism on Earth, was a fungus. Imagine a mushroom the size of a tree, a fairly large tree, as a matter of fact. And so that, and then lots of other, like I said, the fish were very conspicuous when they were present, and there were some very big and some were just grazers and filter feeders and all different kinds of fish that were around in the age of the fish, the Devonian.
Mark in Bloomer has a comment for us. Let's go there. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. So I was a few years back a member of a geological society up in Cameron, and we went on a field trip out to the farm. This farmer had all kinds of glaciated rock in his field. And our jaws hit the ground. We couldn't believe all the things we were finding. And his jaw hit the ground. He couldn't believe we wanted it. He said, "You want more? Take all you want." It was his new society. was our treasure. It was crazy.
Oh, man. Scott, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, our state has been impacted so heavily by the last major glaciation during the Ice Age that the last phase of the Ice Age is called the Wisconsinian, or the Wisconsin Glaciation. As those glaciers bulldozed their way through the state between about 30,000 to about 12 to 15,000 years ago, they sampled many rocks from up on the Canadian Shield, north of Lake Superior, through the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and of course sampling things across the state as it traversed its way through. And among those debris can be found any number of things that are just visiting the state. We have, in our museum, for example, at the Weiss Museum, we have a chunk of float copper, not that it floats, but it was rafted in the ice debris that was found in the center of the state, and it weighs about 400 pounds. So you can find any number of treasures amongst the glacial deposits, including locally derived rocks as well, especially along the beaches of Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
I might add to that life as well. Of course, we had the traditional mastodons and mammoths and elk, bison, things like that. A lot of those that were alive at that time and then either became extinct soon after that or hung on for a little while into the next period. But, yeah, a lot of different kinds of things. And even there were some in Lake Michigan, in large Lake Michigan, which was in existence right after the glaciers melted away, there were actually sperm whales, walruses, sea turtles found in Michigan. They haven't been found in Wisconsin yet, but they were probably here, you know, since Lake Michigan covered all this, a lot of the states. And so there was a lot of life, a lot of change going on as soon as that happened. Then the glaciers melted and the life pretty much returned to what it is pretty much right now.
Yeah. What the continents looked a whole lot different.
In the Paleozoic, yeah, there were a lot of different plates that were moving around. And most of the Paleozoic had North America and, the Devonian time, there was something called Euramerica, and that was North America and Western Europe. And before that, it was Laurentia, which was North America, Greenland, and Scotland, and they were all together as one supercontinent. So things were different. It's hard to say, like when somebody says, what was life like in Milwaukee or in Madison at that time? You'd have to say, well, how old was the rock that we're talking about? Because the rock kind of moves around with the plates, you know. but that's really what we're talking about is the plates moving around a lot. But the inland seas are the things that were always present in the Paleozoic time when most of the rocks were deposited here in Wisconsin.
We're going to talk some more about that with our two guests today, Ken Gass, honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, specializes in the Paleozoic life of Wisconsin, and Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to WPR News. We are traveling back in time to Wisconsin in the Paleozoic area with our two guests today, Larry Miller here, and our guest Ken Gass, honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, and Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. Questions for them as we move along, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You know, our state, we have a state fossil. Does every state, Scott, do you know if every state has a state fossil?
Many states have an official state fossil, but not all states. And we do happen to have a beautiful specimen called of a type of trilobite called Gravicolimini salibra. And you can find that in our Silurian period rocks around the eastern portion of the state, hugging Lake Michigan.
Trilobites, I always thought of it as trilobites, but it's trilobites is how it's pronounced?
Trilobites.
Trilobites. I'll get it right sooner or later.
Three lobes.
Somewhere it's in the back of my head. I'm remembering that it sort of has a relative in a way, or at least the animal that is most closely associated with it is the horseshoe crab. Is that?
That's still considered to be the closest living relative of trilobites. But of course, all the trilobites did become extinct at the end of the Paleozoic. But yeah, that's actually correct. Yeah,
That's cool.
They superficially resemble the sow bugs or isopods. So when they were frightened or endangered, they're threatened, they would roll up for protection, many of those species. And our state fossil is one that could do that, although they're rarely encountered that way rolled up.
Right. The horseshoe crab is closer, though, genetically, or we think it was.
We think so anyway. Jeff and Barry Mills has something for us. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Yes, years ago, I was doing some excavating to make an addition to the house south of La Crosse along the Coon Creek watershed. And it was a clay knoll and red clay, and you'd find gray streaks. And I was about 6-8 feet into the ground, and it was devoid of any rocks. And I came up with about a fist-sized cinder, just a black, shiny, like a coal cinder. And it was just about the only rock I found in there, and I was just wondering if it was of any significance, or you could tell me, you know, what was the origin.
Scott, you have that?
That material was very likely brought down by the glaciers. The area around La Crosse has a lot of Paleozoic limestones and sandstones, things that date to the Cambrian and the Ordovician period. But basalt, which is what a lot of the material that people refer to as cinders, basalt or scoria, are known from areas further north of there from what was called the Mid-Continental Rift. There was a time when Wisconsin and Minnesota almost parted ways and decided to form two separate continents. So that volcanic material likely originated from there.
Oh, really interesting. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, 2-800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. When we're talking about these continents drifting around or Minnesota and Wisconsin moving around, what kind of a time period? It's not like they just up and left overnight.
We're talking about geological time, and it was even for geological time, these things take millions of years to move. In fact, it's almost on a daily basis, it's just a fraction of a millimeter in most cases. But it's with so much geological time, of course, it you can do a lot of movement in that time in billions of years. But I know that there was considerable movement like at in the Devonian, between the Silurian and the Devonian, there seemed to have been more continents moving around at that time. Like I said, through the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, they were pretty much the same as far as the mass that had North America in it. But there were some
Also worth mentioning. It's almost worth mentioning we were south of the equator at that time.
Right.
There we were, south of the equator. Oh, my goodness me.
Through the Paleozoic, it was all pretty much subtropical, as far as the climate.
Oh, my gosh. Mike in Sealy has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Well, I never thought that my rock might have been south of the equator, but anyway, on the property here, we've got the top edge of a real smooth, big piece of rock. And I've always wondered where that might have come from. Now, this is logging area, too, but I don't think they would have moved this rock. Any ideas?
Glaciers, probably, since they can move mountains virtually, bulldoze away large masses of rock and pieces of the continent. They can pretty much grind it down into a meal, and they can move rocks hundreds of miles. Mm-hmm. And boulders bigger, as tall as a room, can be easily moved by some of the glaciers. So I don't doubt that that's a good chance that was moved by a glacier.
Yeah.
Maybe from where? North of here? Or?
Well, I would have to look at the rock to see what kind of rock it is. And most of the glaciers did come from a northerly direction, but some western, and there were different lobes coming down at different glacial stages, but we'd have to look at all of that.
Might have come from Canada, in other words.
It could have. There's a lot of rocks that have come down from Canada.
Yeah. And what color is the rock, by the way? Is it an unusual?
Oh, it's sort of a grayish with, you know, a little bit lighter, and it's really smooth. It's been here forever, I'm sure.
Depending where you're located, you might be seeing a rock that has itself been glacially scoured. As it sort of ran over, well, I'm familiar with the Milwaukee area, the sort of bulldozed through the Milwaukee area, that rock itself might contain scratches from small fragments of rocks trapped between the ice and the bedrock itself that will indicate what direction the ice was even flowing, which is one of the fascinating things that we have here with our ice age deposits.
Interesting. Thanks, Mike. And at one point, we were underwater, weren't we, in Wisconsin?
Oh yes, yeah. And most of the state was submerged for a great part of the Paleozoic era. I mean, we were near the sea in some cases. In fact, in the Cambrian period, we were right on a seashore, basically the edge of the landmass that was covering that was where Wisconsin is now. And there were large inland seas that would come up over the land, and the life would follow it, and the fossils, of course, would follow. And but that's pretty much what most of the fossils are that you'll find in the Paleozoic were marine animals and plants, mostly marine animals, and stromatolites. Like I said, those are going through all along, and those are bacteria.
And there was a almost what you'd call a mass extinction that occurred at some point. Now, Scott, maybe go to you for that.
Yeah, we've had actually a few mass extinctions that came through. Our rocks in Wisconsin don't specifically record those events. They're not from the specific windows of time, but there have been mass extinction events that occurred at the end of the Ordovician period. There was another one at the end of the Devonian, and most people are familiar with the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, thinking that that was the largest. But in fact, the marker for the end of the Paleozoic era was, in fact, the Great End Permian mass extinction, which was part of my research for my grad program. But that one is often referred to as the Great Dying, and we don't have rocks from that period, though.
So what do we know what happened?
Over 90%. Yeah. I'm sorry. Over 90% of the species were wiped out during that extinction, during the end Permian extinction. And I think it was also in the same ballpark with the one that wiped out the dinosaurs at the end of the end Permian one, which is the beginning. I'm sorry, the end of the Cretaceous. That was another extinction event, which wiped out the last of the dinosaurs. And it wiped out a lot of other things, too. But I think, like you said, like Scott said, the biggest extinction, I think, was the end Permian. Yeah, like you said, that was a very big one.
Scott, anything to add to that?
Yeah, each extinction sort of had their own flavors. What contributed to the extinctions in many cases appeared to be abrupt shifts in the climate. Save for the end of the dinosaurs, which, of course, everyone knows about the giant asteroid, but it turns out that may have been sort of the final nail in the coffin of a series of bad events involving climate change, volcanism, and just a lot of bad things happening all at once.
Yeah. Russ in Belleville, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks, Larry. I was wondering, I do a lot of hiking around in the Bearwood Bluffs, which supposedly are the oldest mountains in Wisconsin, or former mountains, and they're made out of quartzite. So does that quartzite contain any fossils in it?
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. We can't see any body fossils or anything in that quartzite, largely because they predate the multicellular fossil record. But in areas sort of like Abelman's Gorge, which is in Rock Springs, Wisconsin, really nearby, and some of the bluffs around Devil's Lake State Park, you can see ripple marks. That is the sculpted sand from that ancient ocean, which dates to about 1.7 billion years ago. So you could walk on an ancient beach that has been heated and compressed and converted into quartzite today.
Wow. Russ, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Rose emailed, their favorite fossil is the crinoid?
Crinoid.
Crinoid?
Yes.
I'll go with that, yeah.
So explain that, crinoid. What was...
Yeah, those were the closest... Well, they're still alive today in the seas. They were all marine. They were all echinoderms. Echinoderms were the animals that had a spiny skin, which is what echinoderm means. But the biggest thing is they had a water vascular system, like you'd find on the bottom of a starfish, mm-hmm. which is also an echinoderm. But crinoids were stalked... animals. They had a stalk that they used and mostly attached to the substrate with. Sometimes they were free-floating and some even lacked a stalk, but they had the five arms or some multiples of fives generally, sort of like a starfish would, and that's the general layout or body plan of the starfish, the water vascular system and some multiple of five type of a symmetry.
Pretty cool. She said their favorite geologic, Rose said her favorite geological feature is the Great Uniformity by Devil's Lake. Scott, what do you know the Great Uniformity?
Is it? I hadn't heard it referenced. No. They may be referencing an unconformity.
Yeah. I'm sorry. That's exactly what she said. I just misread it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Great okay. Unconformity by Devil's Lake.
An unconformity is a surface where you have contiguous deposition of rock being truncated or completely cut off, and then you have a large gap in time of missing deposition, so that the rocks laying on top of the ancient underlying rocks often can be a billion years apart, 2 billion years apart. And in the case of the area around Devil's Lake, all those rocks that I'd mentioned from that Baraboo quartzite date to about 1.7 billion years ago, and especially in Abelman's Gorge, you can see at the top of some of the rock outcrops a stark transition to a sandstone filled with cobbles and rocks in it, and those date to the Cambrian period. So you're missing about 1.2 billion years of geologic history in between those two layers of rock.
Wow. Bill in Oshkosh has something for us. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, my question is, after each mass extinction, how come there's such a different group of animals that develops after that?
It's completely different. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
That would be due to what we call niche vacating. In other words, you have certain animals that made a living where they lived, how they lived. For example, in the ocean, were they on top of the seafloor? Did they burrow into it? That once you have a mass extinction, many of those organisms that occupy that lifestyle have disappeared. So they get replaced by novel species that are exploiting that now available resource. So a good example between the dinosaurs and today would be things like pack hunters like the raptors or the solitary predators like T-Rex would be replaced by mammals later, things like pack hunting wolves or a solitary lion or some sort of animal that doesn't really hunt in large groups. So that's why you see a mass diversity shortly following any sort of mass extinction. The greater the extinction and larger loss of life, usually the more novel things you see in the immediate aftermath.
And I think that filling the niches is the biggest thing. But also, if you're looking at it from a micro level, just looking at, like, for example, the Devonian of Wisconsin, there are some little minor areas where there has been the sea has withdrawn and there wasn't any more deposition of rock, of material. And then it came back again. And when it came back, it might have brought back a little bit different, and this is sort of another kind of an unconformity. It brought back a different mixture of the animals. It wasn't the same thing. They maybe not have been species that were new, but they may have been new to the area or in a different relative abundance. So you can see a pretty big, just in fact, in Estabrook Park in Milwaukee, where I've done a whole lot of work, you can see that happening. You can look at one layer. You can see a little area. A plane of contact between the two stratas that show that there was some dissolution, some dissolving of the sediment surface, so you know that the sea withdrew then and then it came back again. And you can see a different proportion of the animals that did come back. So that's not really a matter of evolution. It's just a matter of migration, basically coming back and where they had picked up some other species from other sources of water that came in, of currents or whatever that came in.
So these continental movements, too, must have affected the sort of the distribution and evolution of marine and land life.
Absolutely. Yeah, as the continents moved, there were ocean basins that became completely isolated. So it would be, if imagine sea level drops and there ends up being a land bridge that connects Florida through to Cuba down to Mexico. You would have a separate isolated basin now where evolution can take place in its own little environment within the Gulf of Mexico versus the rest of the Atlantic proper. And we see events like that having occurred across Wisconsin, and that is reflected in the fossil record. We'll see isolation. You can see certain species go extinct while new ones migrate in. There are quite a few events like that occur in our rock layers. You just have to kind of know what to look for.
Yeah. And somebody else emailed in wondering if you could talk more, Scott, about your research, your graduate research, more about that. You mentioned it kind of in passing.
I did, yes. I was studying rocks under Dr. Margaret Fraser when she was at UW-Milwaukee, and I was looking at rocks in the immediate aftermath of the end Permian mass extinction. So that was the Great Dying, where lots of species were entirely wiped out. And I did study little shell-bearing creatures called brachiopods. They happen to be my favorite things in the fossil record. They're enormously diverse. They superficially resemble clams, although their symmetry is a little different. And they were exclusively marine, and their diversity made them a really good test subject for watching things like mass extinction, because they sort of serve as the canary in the coal mine. When conditions go south, then you'll see the populations among this really once diverse group of organisms shift. Some species that had once been dominant or common go extinct. Other ones show up, and in the case of the end Permian mass extinction, they transition from being once the most dominant shell-bearing organism in the Paleozoic oceans. So that would mean if you were walking on a beach, instead of finding clams and snails, almost all the shells would be brachiopods, to being relegated to the deep seas and really harsh environments immediately after the extinction. So they're just really a fascinating little creature that tells you an awful lot about the environments at that time, especially important given that the end Permian mass extinction is largely attributed to runaway global warming.
Rick in Rhinelander has a couple of questions for us, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question. You had mentioned quartzite in the Baraboo Bluff still showing the ripple marks from ancient oceans. I've been out west and seen that in sandstone. But I'm curious, is the quartzite, was that previously sand, and then you said it was heating and compression and still retained its ripples? What is the process that by which that occurred, and is that how quartzite is formed? Now, my second question is the iron deposits up in the UP. I've been told that the reason they're there, they were pure iron by Ishpeming, was due to the composition of the ocean actually changing from sort of a oxygenated ocean to a reductive ocean that allowed that pure iron to kind of precipitate out. I was wondering about that as well.
Okay, a couple of questions. Scott, maybe we start with you.
Sure, I can address the quartzite. So quartzite is a metamorphic rock. It does occur when you have sandstone getting compressed, heated by tectonic forces in the case of Wisconsin. Around 1.8 billion years ago, there were a series of islands that were sort of rafting their way to the continental margin where present-day Wisconsin is. And as these little island masses and other marine floor started to pile onto the continent, it folded it up and created these series of what we call anticlines and synclines, these up and down sort of undulating layers of rock. And it's that compression that converted the once sandstone and heated it and formed it into quartzite. But it did manage to preserve the ripples. It wasn't so heavily altered that we lost that detail. So we're really fortunate to have those deposits.
Yeah, and Ken, maybe you can talk about or add to that.
Those ripple marks are really abundant in Wisconsin in the Cambrian rocks. The ones at Blackberry Hill, which is, I've written a book about that. They're, again, most of that rock is sandstone, but a lot of it has been metamorphosed a little bit, so it's now orthoquartzite, which is a type of quartzite produced by metamorphism of sandstone. So we do have a lot of ripples, really beautiful, bizarre-looking ripples of all different patterns. In the, it's called the Elk Mound Group of Wisconsin, which is about a half a billion years old. That's the one that preserves the oldest animals ever found that walked on land, were found, discovered right there in central Wisconsin in the Elk Mound Group.
And the iron deposits, Rick had a question about the iron and how it was formed and so forth. Is his supposition correct as to the water creating? Go ahead, Scott.
I'm not entirely sure of the processes that contributed specifically to those iron deposits, but during that time period when those rocks were forming, oxygen levels in the atmosphere and subsequently in the ocean itself dissolved into it were far lower. And so iron could be dissolved into the ocean waters without precipitating out. And it's only when oxygen levels started to increase in the atmosphere by activity of things like those stromatolites, that cyanobacteria, that it would cause the iron to precipitate out and form hematite layers on the sea floor. And so many of the layers you see in north central Wisconsin and parts that extend up into those iron ranges into the Ishpeming area of Michigan are comprised of banded rock that has rust layers from when the bacteria was converting that iron into in the water into true hematite and depositing it, and black layers that aren't oxidized, and that happens when the bacteria actually kill themselves off. Oxygen was toxic to those earliest organisms forming those iron stones back then. So I do know at least that's the history of some of those rocks in that area. As to what contributed all the rest of the iron, that may be the case or may not be.
Yeah. I was thinking about northern Wisconsin. I can remember being in the Shawabigan National Forest with some folks, and we were using compasses to travel from, you know, hopefully straight north or whatever. I don't remember the direction, but one of the guys was maybe 100 steps over from me, and I said, all right, straight north, and he had it one way, and I had another, and I said, wait a minute, there's a lot of iron in the earth in the northern Wisconsin, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
it was really something compare our compasses for sure. Ken Gass, one of our guests today, honorary curator at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh. I'm Larry Mailer. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look way, way, way back in Wisconsin to the Paleozoic area with our two guests, Ken Gass, honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, and Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh, Fox City's campus. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And Ken, I thought you mentioned Blackberry Hill sort of in passing. Can you talk a little bit more? Where is it? What's important about it?
Sure. That's the one that I touched on before. It's Cambrian in age, the rock that's there. It's probably, in my opinion, it's the most significant discovery in paleontology in the state's history. What it does, it solves a mystery that was going on since the 1800s, the middle 1800s, in the times of Charles Darwin and Richard Owen, the guy who made up the word dinosaur. He also named the first footprints that were given an official name called Protychnites. Nobody knew what the animal was that made those. But we just, all we did know is that whatever that the animal was that made those footprints were the first animals to walk on land. And the animal was evasive up until a discovery at Black Bear Hill, Wisconsin, which is about in Mosinee area, a little bit outside of, it's called Gunther. Actually, the town of Gunther is what is really nearest. And it's a series of quarries that contain the ripples that I was talking about,
yeah,
and the first animals to walk on land, and the footprints that they made, and even fossils that showed the animal making those footprints. And that's kind of how we know that was what the proof was, that we knew what the animal was that made them. So we've discovered after 150 years what the first animal was to walk on land. In other words, the first one to take the first steps out of the sea and actually start to move around, only in a basically an amphibious state where they would return back to the water. Maybe they're trying to make it from one tide pool to another. Because this was a tidal, the intertidal and the supertidal, and even up into the dunes, the high and dry in the dunes that they were walking. Mm. So that was a big thing about the Cambrian in Wisconsin, except for there's another big thing in Wisconsin that, and a lot of other discoveries were made at Black Bear Hill as well.
Yeah.
But then there was another thing, that's these things called the glaspidids, which were another type of arthropod animal that was segmented. And more of those have been found in Wisconsin than anywhere else. And those were, it's been called a glaspidid central, in fact, Wisconsin sometimes is called, because of that. And that's another thing. But going back to Blackberry Hill, in the same period, the Cambrian period, Blackberry Hill also had the largest and the first mass strandings of jellyfish in the fossil record. And so that was another big thing. So I don't want to go into too much detail because, as I mentioned, I talked about the Cambrian and two other programs on here before.
Yeah.
It could go off for hours on end about the discoveries made there.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. How did the, what adaptations did the creatures have to make to, you know, the first ones that stepped out of the water?
Well, the ones that stepped out of the water, if they couldn't get back to the water or couldn't get to a tide pool or some other place where they wouldn't dry out and they wouldn't die, then they would die if they would, if they didn't have the kinds of appendages or ambulation required to move around enough. So that was the one thing about these things. They were called euthycarcinoids is what the animals were. And their legs weren't really, really well suited for walking very well, but good enough to get them from one tide pool to another or back to the ocean. So we think that that was the transition that happened to this amphibious lifestyle that enabled them to develop and adapt and develop into eventually fully terrestrial, one of the fully terrestrial kinds of animals. Of course, many kinds of animals came out of the sea at different times, but as far as the arthropods go, this may have been close to the animals, the first animals that really did become fully terrestrial, which were the another kind of an arthropod, basically millipedes. And and then, of course, the fish came much later. They started back in the Devonian period, which was like three periods after the Cambrian. So we think of the, if you look at the internet and look up what was the first animal to walk on land, you're going to find fish, Tiktaalik or something like that. But they weren't. The euthycarcinoids in Wisconsin were coming, doing that way over 100 million years before that. So
we were first.
We were. We had the first ones to show what the animal was.
John in Port Wing, let's go to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. I've got a question about fossil identification. Is there a resource where the public could send photos of fossils and get some kind of a possible identification?
Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a couple places to be able to do that. There is a public forum online. It's called the Fossil Forum. They're pretty good at that. I used to frequent that website as well. But we even have at the museum, our website, we have an info WESM website. So it's info WESM at gmail.com. And the public often submits rock and fossil identifications to that website. We also host at the museum occasionally a rock identification day, where we encourage the public to bring in their treasures, and we love going through what they have found and identifying things for them.
That's pretty
cool. There's multiple resources.
Ken, is the Milwaukee Public Museum involved in any of that, do you know, or that sort of thing?
I'm not sure what official things that they have to accommodate that, but I think that I know that the curators at the museum, Pat Burke, who works there, she's the main curator, she gets a lot of requests from people. I'm sure she gets a lot of photographs sent to her and other things, but there might be something more official than that. I'm just not really aware of what that is. That's not part of the things that I've done for them.
for them over time. So what do you think about the research itself? How does understanding, I ask both of you to comment on this, what does understanding what happened back then help us today?
Extinctions happen.
Just knowing.
I'm not asking a question. I'm giving an answer.
Yeah.
to me, what fossils tell us is that if we're not careful, we could be one of them. The extinction does happen. And that's something that I'm reminded of every time I pick up a fossil. And I think we can pick that up and use that in our lives to remember that what we're doing on this planet makes a difference, because the planet is always changing. We may or may not be here depending on what we do.
Well said. Scott, comment from you.
A phrase that you often hear out of geologists is that the past is the key to the present. So not only can we track things like environmental change and extinctions and how they affect the organisms, but what it allows us to do is something we cannot do in the present. If something does cause a mass extinction, not only can we see the record and climate data that we can get from the rocks and population counts from the species in the fossil record, but we can see that before the extinction, as it's setting up, as the extinction is in full swing, and even after the extinction, the aftermath. And so the rock record, for many reasons, is one of the best ways that we can make sense of what is going on our planet today and try to predict some future effects of what is going on, in this case, like things like climate change.
Yeah, that's how do you guys look at climate change? Given the history that you've studied of your careers.
Well, I know
very
that
carefully.
Yeah, very yeah. carefully, and I know that there are several things happening. We are still sort of coming out of the last ice age, so there's a little bit of warming and raising of sea levels coming from that. But starting with the Industrial Revolution, it was either a really mm-hmm. big coincidence or something is happening that we're doing that's making that accelerate.
Yeah. Scott?
It serves as sort of a cautionary tale. Because we can track things in the aftermath of an extinction, it lets us know really what level of impact we're having. Right now, if you were to look at the rock record, between today and going to as far back as 40 or 50,000 years ago, that package of rock in the present is something that we could say, okay, we're recording 50,000 years of time here. But if you were to travel back and look at the packages of rock from the Devonian period, a span of time like 40 or 50,000 years would look almost instantaneous as a strata of rock in, say, the Devonian or the Silurian. And so the effects that we're having today, such as, extinction of some of the larger fauna, for example, everyone cites the polar bear is critically endangered because of melting sea ice. Well, in the rock record itself, things like the disappearance of the woolly mammoth and the mastodon or the scimitar-toothed cat would all look almost instantaneous if we were to transport ourselves 10 million years into the future. And so understanding the rapidity of these extinctions is something that I think has the biggest consequence for us and the most important thing with what we're looking at today.
Ken, Scott, thank you both so much for being with us today. It was a quick hour, and hopefully we can do this again. Ken Gass is honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum. Scott Schaefer, Interim Director of the WISE Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh Fox City's campus. Thank you for listening in today. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.